Welcome to the Modern Drummer Podcast. I'm Modern Drummer's CEO, publisher, David Frangioni, my co-host, Billy Amendola, and we're here featuring the world's most prolific drummers, listening to what they have to say, and bringing to you from inside the studio, the world of drumming. Billy?
Hello, everyone. Billy Amendola. Tune in to some really interesting facts on the Modern Drummer Podcast. Welcome to the Modern Drummer Podcast. I'm here with David Frangioni and the one and only Ash Schoen. Now, Ash, for those, welcome. For those that may not know, Ash has had 58 albums in the top 10 that he has played on. He's on 17 top 10 singles, and there's no stopping him. It's just, I mean, I've known about him, and I've been a fan for, oh my God, years, maybe 10 years now. And of course, he's in the UK. We're here in the US. So everyone say hello to Ash Schoen. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Billy.
So how are you holding up? How's everything going?
Everything's going great. I mean, you know, it's been horrendous the last year and a bit, but I've got this little place and I've been really, really lucky. There's been like a steady, you know, artists are still, people are, in fact, arguably got more time than they've ever had before. So there's a lot of people writing. So there's lots of ideas coming through my computer and people wanting to use this place. So I've been very, very busy.
Yeah, your studio is incredible from the video and the photos. It's called the Windmill, right?
Yeah, there was a windmill originally here when we bought the property. It was like the ruins of the bottom of a windmill. And then I needed to basically get my drums out of the house or my wife was going to leave me. So so it was either convert, we've got some old barns next to the house. It was either convert those. And it was just the timing of it. Basically a friend of the family said, what about the windmill? And I was like, well, there's not much left of it. And he said, well, we could kind of restore the bottom section to what it was like, and you'd have a lovely round room right across the field, well away from everyone. And he said if we build it and make it out of straw bales, then it'll be green, you know, a green build. And also that material has turned out to be, you know, straw has turned out to be a fantastic absorbent material
sound.
And also outside, people don't hear it outside, but it also sounds great in here. Wow. But just by luck, really, you know, it was not, I'd like to say, oh yeah, we engineered it from the top down, but we didn't. We just chucked some stuff at the place and it's just turned into what it's turned into.
It's meant to be. So now that's on your property, near your property?
Yeah, so that's on the field next to my house, which...
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. I've seen, and if anybody, they should go to ashstone.com, of course. You have a great website set up, and there's the videos you've been posting lately on Instagram have been fantastic, and the studio is great. Now, what drums do you endorse? Who do you endorse?
I'm with Gretsch. So
with Gretsch.
I've been with Gretsch now for 5 years with Gretsch.
Nice.
So there's a broadcaster kit set up here all the time. One of the things that when I was working, I used to work at Trevor Horn's studio, Psalm, in Portobello, which isn't there now, sadly, but it used to be the old Island Records. And one of the things years ago, you know, 15, 20 years ago, I used to say to the guys that the engineers and the studio lads, you know, what's the biggest pain about a drum session. And they would say, well, setting it up, microphones, 2 hours, eventually get a sound, play on the track, which could take 30 minutes. And then we break it all down. And then next time we have to do the whole thing again. And they were saying, you know, one of the things that's great is if you can leave a kit in a position and then you can tweak the sound, you can adjust the microphones each time you record, you might want to tweak it a little bit. And it sort of got the cogs moving for me way back then. Like I thought, if I ever get a place, the gear's going to stay and I'm going to do what the lads recommended all those years ago. So this kit never moves. The microphones haven't moved in nearly 10 years now.
Wow. So how long have you had the studio now?
Well, it's going to be 10 years next year.
God bless. That's fantastic. Yeah. That's great. Because I know you've been doing a lot of the sessions. So how did you get into the whole recording and doing all the electronic? Because obviously you were ahead of the game, perfect for, unfortunately, what went on.
I know. It's bizarre. I mean, I built the place, like I say, to get all of my paraphernalia out of the house, or it was curtains from the wife. So, you know, she didn't want any discs on the wall or any of that. It's like, it's a house. It's not a rock and roll memorabilia place. And I get it, you know. So, and it's kind of cool that I've got a bit of a man den with all my gear from the history, from stuff I've played on, and, you know, laminate.
She doesn't realize that was the greatest
thing ever. Absolutely, yeah. And so initially we built it just to get my gear in, and then somebody said to me, what's it sound like? I was like, good point. They said, well, just a producer said, just stick a couple of mics up, get Logic on your laptop, put a couple of mics up and send it to me. So I sent it to this producer, and he said, the room sounds pretty cool. You know, there's real producers can tell from one pretty good microphone what the room's like, you know. So I did that, and then we started messing around a little bit with a couple of more microphones. And then I thought, I've either got to take the plunge and invest in some gear, or just trickle it along and, you know, maybe buy another mic, get another preamp. So I just bit the bullet and went for it. And I invested relatively heavily in some preamps and interfaces and outboard gear and mics, and I kind of went for it.
And then you also learned how to use it.
Well, so that's the thing that I've always been fascinated in when I've been on sessions. I've been watching guys, like we all have, you know, all recording, all session drummers. You do a take in the real world, in our old blueprint of doing a session. You're there, you're hired, you play on the drums, you come in and you sit down and you listen back with the producer, artist, possibly. And there's a Pro Tools operator, and I always watch and listen to what they're doing. And it's always fascinated me, the whole process of it. So I completely dived in, and another producer, it was like, which DAW are you going to use? Are you going to use Logic? You know, where are you going to, because they're all new to me. And luckily one or two producers just said, just dive straight in and learn Pro Tools. So over the last 10 years, I'm still an absolute novice, but compared to what I was 10 years ago, I can almost get around it. You know, I'd hate to do a real session with a producer breathing down my neck, but when I'm in here and in my own time, I can get a sound definitely now. And I know how my rig works, and I know how all my microphones work in here. And yeah, it seems to be working, you know.
Well, you've proven it too, because of all the hit records that you played on. So, and a lot of them are recorded there, correct?
Well, this is the next thing. It's all very well. I'd played on albums that were successful before I got the studio, and that's all well and good. But then it's like, now I've got to try and convince people that I can do it here. And the biggest one was that it's me that's putting the microphones on the drums, setting the level of on the gain, setting the compression, and then sending the files. And all the producers were like, the only way anyone's ever going to believe that you can do it is like it's always been. You got to have a hit. You know, you just got to have a hit from
have
here.
To prove, yeah, you have to prove it.
You just got to, no one cares until that happens. And then they go, oh, hang on. This guy,
he knows what he's doing.
He's at a number one, and we had, you know, had a number one relatively early on. And then there was a Grammy nomination for a record that I played on here. And that was a biggie. That was like, okay, that's kind of, you know, not many people took notice, but the people that matter took notice. Right. So like some of the producers were like, hang on a minute. He's obviously getting to the point where he's playing on things that now from here that are starting to create. And then a couple of number ones later, it's like, okay, you can do it. And now it's fantastic, you know.
And you've even had major people rent out the studio.
Yeah, I've had, so when I did the Lion King, the producer that I worked with, Hans Zimmer did the music for the Lion King, but the producer that he used at the time was a guy, Steve Lipson, that I've worked with before with Trevor Horn. And he came up, hired it, and me, and said, you know, I want to come and basically do the session here with me, which is, you know, unusual, but he did it. And yeah, it's anything goes. That's
great.
COVID, of course, you know.
David, did you want to, because David's an engineer and he runs studios and builds studios. David, do you have any questions about the studio?
Well, it sounds like he's got all the bases covered. I mean, I love the fact that you keep everything set up. And, yeah. You know, from there, you're going to have a very consistent sound and everything you do is going to be very deliberate, which in the case of having efficiency and being able to go from track to track, artist to artist, you know, you want to make the call yourself saying, okay, I want this snare drum to sound a certain way, or I want to, you know, and it's intentional because you know the room and you know the setup so well. That it's like, okay, if I use this drum with this mic and this setting, then it's going to have the depth I want, or it's going to have the crack that I want. And so what are some of the things that you've taken from those experiences over the years of having your studio that you can share with other drummers who are going down this journey, who want to have, you know, be able to have successful recordings done in their own studio?
Yeah. You know, like so many guys now send me questions about it. You know, it's really interesting how it's changed, you know. Like not that many years ago, it was always like, oh, what's that thing you're doing with your left hand when you're playing that groove? Da, 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 da. It was always a technical question. Sometimes you get a gear question, you know, what snare did you use? But now, it absolutely, you know, 95% of the time, people are asking me, like, so what mic have you got on your overheads? You know, and what snare drum? What's the mic on the bottom of the snare? It's continual because everybody is getting into it. And you know, there are some guys that aspire to be playing on hit records, and then there's other guys that all they want to do is when they post something on Facebook, they want to make it the best they possibly can, and they enjoy, like a lot of people are now, the whole experience of sticking a microphone on a drum and what happens when you put that thing there, when it goes down the wire. You know, that sort of, it's almost like it's still pretty mysterious, you know, for me, and I kind of know, but it's the magic of it is like something happens when it goes to a preamp and then a bit of outboard gear or into Pro Tools with the plugins, some sort of, you know, magical stuff happens. So to answer your question there, David, really, I mean, I guess it takes time and, you know, I always say to people, just start with one or two mics. If you know, if you're a novice and you're getting into it, try not to buy, you know, everything and just jump straight in, because that's really tricky. But if you can get a couple of microphones sounding good and starting to understand phase, which is the biggest deal really with drums, you know, when you get so many microphones on an instrument and they're in all sorts of different positions and the sound's hitting all of those microphones at different times, then there's the phase, I guess simply put, you want the speakers and the microphones and the sound to move all at the same time. And that's when you get the fullest, most solid, consistent sound. And if it's hitting microphones at different times, if the snare drum's hitting a mic at a different time, it's going to actually physically move your speakers. Your speakers are going to be wobbling around, and then it starts to sound a bit weird. And that often is a phase issue. So I always say to people, try with one mic, get two mics sounding good, get a third mic, and build it from there, and just take it easy and take little steps, and you will, you know, not only, well, I think in the end, the result of the sound will be better, but you'll have a much more sort of comprehensive understanding of it all if you take your time. It's like everything. If you jump in on a David Garibaldi groove right in with both feet, it's gonna knock you off your bike. But if you take your time with David's grooves, eventually you'll be able to get them. And it's the same with everything. It's the same with recording, I feel. Take it easy, and eventually, if you understand how that one mic works on your snare drum or your bass drum, add another one, and just take your time. That's the best advice, I think, really.
Great. And what have you found as some of your favorite snare drums to record? Yeah. And from a drummer's perspective, what's some of the best sounding stuff you're using that's really reproducing well?
There's one that I'm loving. There's a couple here. So this is a Max Roach signature snare. And I think I was talking to Lucas von Gretsch, and he was saying these lugs here, I think they call them streamline lugs. It's 1954, so it's 50s, this.
Wow.
And it's 4 inches, but I get the fattest sound. It's got a black dot on it, quite a well-used black dot with just...
Now, when you say you get a fat sound, is that because of the way it's tuned? You have it tuned down to that thuddy type?
It is tuned down, but what I've been experimenting over the years, if you get a really deep drum and you detune it, you're going to get a big, low sounding, obviously. But what happens when you start playing and there's other instruments that come into the mix is that the lower, you don't get any front from the drum. So I just realized a little while ago that if you detune a shallower drum, it retains the sort of front end of the sound. So you get, like, there is still some top from it. So you get a lovely fat sound, but with some attack. And it's one of the best sounding fat backbeats I've got out of that drum, really.
You know? Wow.
And it's there, and it works on so many pop things and so many sort of funk things. Then I've got another 50s drum here. Where is it? Here it is. So this is a 50s round badge. And this is a 5.5. And I think it's Bermuda sand, they call that. And this is a mega sounding drum. Really kind of contemporary sort of hip hop sounds I'm getting out of it. And if you detune, it's got a really great rocky sound. I've got about 50 snare drums around the studio, but these two are the ones I'm going for.
The two from the 50s.
Yeah, right.
The 50s ones are great. I've got some 50s K hats, which I use all the time. I've got some lovely 70s A hi-hats. And I was very lucky. I play with Hamish Stewart, you know, from the Average White Band.
Oh, I love Hamish.
Yeah, and I've been very fortunate to know Hamish sort of over half my life, and I've played on and off with him. And I was playing a gig in a little club about 4 years ago in Chelsea in London. And I took my, there's a kit there, but I always take my cymbals and my own snare. And I took these down, these A's, and these are the same age as me. They're 1969, these. Paul Francis from Zildjian recognized the bell, and he said that they're either 68 or 69, and he had a little bit more of a sort of, got his glasses on and had a bit of a look, and he said they're probably like 1969. I said, that's me. I was born in 1969.
Wow.
But I was using these hats on that Hamish gig, and I was halfway through the first set, and Steve Ferroni walks in, which is slightly off-putting, if I'm honest with you. So Steve comes in, and as we're I'm playing like an average white band tune, which Steve probably played on, and I hear Hamish go, hey, Steve. And I'm like, oh, brilliant. It's going to turn in. Anyway, cut long story short, he did the second set, and I sat on the floor behind him and just witnessed the Ferroni in full swing. And I got him to sign them. So these are the...
Wow.
These are the Steve hats, because he used them that night. And they're fantastic. I use them on pretty much everything. I've got one more to show you.
Oh, I have one of those myself, actually.
Yeah, so 1976, Acrolite. Yep. You know, not Acrolite. Where are we? It is a Ludwig...
Superphonic?
Yeah, Superphonic, yep, correct. Superphonic. It's the Alley. It's the Alley one.
With the black dot. Can't beat that.
Exactly. And I use this on all sorts of stuff. I mean, it is honestly... If anyone said, which I know I'm a Gretchen Dorsey and I should be telling them to buy Gretsch drums, and they are fantastic drums. But if you're a working session musician, and one of these is it's got to be in your box, really. So,
and oh, that snare drum in the 70s was probably the most, and a Black Beauty, of course, but was one of the most used snare drums of all time.
And they're not silly money. You know, you can still pick these up, and they're still pretty reasonably priced.
Yeah, they're affordable. You know,
they're not out of anyone's reach, really. And then they're fantastic drums. And this one gets a lot of use.
You know, while we're talking about sessions and playing on sessions now, let's get away from the gear.
Yeah.
Let's get into some playing. I just want to remind everybody, like I said, you had 58 records in the top 10 albums. You had 17 top 10 singles. I mean, it's incredible. Some of the people that you've played with, Adele, Rod Stewart, Julian Lennon, Taylor Swift, Ed Sheeran, Seal, Cher, Alicia Keys, Ronan Keating, who a lot of people don't know. I've been a fan of Ronan since he was in, I forget the boy band that he was in.
Boyzone.
Take That. Was that Take That?
No, that's Gary Barlow.
That's Robbie Williams.
And Robbie Williams was in Take That.
Robbie Williams, because I love both those guys. Who was Ronan in?
So Ronan was in a band called Boyzone.
Right. Yeah. I always get, and Robbie was in Take That.
That's
a
right.
A lot of people, I've been a fan of the British music scene for so, I mean, once the Beatles came out and I was aware of what music came out of England, ABC, yeah. Thompson Twins, all those bands. I mean, I love all. So you've played with and Dua Lipa. So it's like you're relevant. It's not like, you know, people can say, well, yeah, he played on all this stuff back then, you know, throughout the years, at least the last 10 years, you've been so, to this day, relevant of all these people that you've played with. And I think we always talk about this. One, of course, you have the talent. While we talk about the talent, you have a feel that is such a smooth, beautiful feel that you can, that you know comes from your heart. Do you think feel is a natural thing, or what's your feelings about that? Do you think feel can be taught? I know that's a complex question.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. People, you know, what's interesting about recording now, if you think about Jeff back in the day, you know, there's all those stories that we know about him getting roasted by
Ricky Lee Jones.
And everybody play to the click, bang, 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 you know, trying to make him play as close to machine-like as possible. And he's one of the only guys, I think, that could do it and have almost metronomic time. Vinny, of course, obviously, without question. Maintain that heart in their playing. But what's interesting now, of course, with modern recording techniques is that bit, they can make people in time instantly. You know, you can get somebody who's has been playing for a year and put them in as good a time as any of those 70s records or 80s records. You know, it's a weird thing. You know, but what they can't do is the thing that you've just talked about, which is now people want movement and they want the feel aspect of playing more than ever, because that's the thing they can't program. That's the thing they can't emulate. That's the thing they can't twiddle. Well, they can, but it takes them weeks to get it to almost feel like a real drummer. It's like, well, get a real drummer in. And, you know, that movement, that exciting movement, and it might only be a little bit. You might still be playing to a click, in fact, but there's still an energy movement when it goes into the chorus, and it might lay back a little bit, but you're still playing to the click, right? You're in time.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they're the things, you know, that I think that really matter. And it's I think it's really exciting now for drummers still, you know, we're still not gone. You know,
they're not getting rid of us. Drum machines.
That's right.
They never scared me. I embraced it. I loved it.
That's right. So did I, you know, and I, in fact, you know, one of my first gigs that I got when I toured was with the band called Delamitri, and I got that gig because I could play, and I still play with that band, because I could play to a click. And back in the early 90s, there were still guys that didn't really feel comfortable playing to a click, you know, in the early 90s.
What's your approach to electronics?
Well, I mean, most of the time when I'm playing to modern pop records, there's something programmed in the mix that I'm going to play to. And to be honest with you, you know, it's still the same approach. I still play traditionally how I would play on that tune if I was in the band and everybody was in the room. And then it's often down then to the producer that will take aspects of that playing. So like for instance, that Alicia Keys, I played on a track called Underdog, but also so did Stephen Wolfe. And we were chatting, Stephen and I, and it's amazing to be honest that they took my stems, they went over to New York, and sometimes you might not even get a credit. You know, the stuff that you've played on will disappear into the whole mush of the record making process. But what the engineer that I work with and the producer that I work with here on that record, they're old school and they're fastidious, and they marked my stems Ashstone. And then when it went to New York and got to Alicia's people, aspects of my playing made it onto the record, as also did Stephen. So we're still sort of debating, is it my hi-hats? Is it my backbeat? Is it his snare drum? So in answer to your question, I guess, you know, we still, I think most session players will just play instinctively how we would play to that tune. And then the producers then in a contemporary way will take aspects of that and use it however they will.
Do you trigger your drums?
I never trigger. No, one of the things that I'm really enjoying about my studio and the sound is the processing that's involved to make some of those really cool snare drum sounds or hi-hat sounds or kick sounds. I'm loving that whole process. So I definitely don't trigger. But I know for a fact that I've probably been sound replaced. They call it sound replaced. So they will layer a sample on top of your drum that you put down. That's a kind of old.
And plugins. There's so many plugins. After you do your session, you never know what they're going to do with plugins. And
it's so much can be done. And I'm learning how to do it. But I'm still traditionally messing around with the sonics of the mics and the preamps and the plugins myself and trying to process that sound. So it's not I never use samples in the stuff that people hear, you know, on social media.
And hats off to Steve Wolf, because Steve is one of the greatest at that. He gets close to like not knowing if it's a machine or if it's real or... He's very, very good. He's been doing that for so long. He's very, very good at that.
And you know, I think he's the same as me. I think he's just sort of tried to keep up with, you know, contemporary sounds.
And always learning. Always learning. Yeah. You know,
learn a new thing. Yeah, exactly. And when I spoke to him, we've met a few times, and it's really, you know, it's just straight away. We've been operating in the same world, in different worlds, but in the same place. And there's so many similarities in our lives, the way we've learned and sessions and the way things happened for both of us. And it's great. I often, you know, we chat and exchange on social media quite often, me and Stephen. Yeah, I love
it. Yeah, Steve, I know Steve a long time. He's a great guy.
Yeah.
I see him when he's here in New York. Now he's been going back and forth from here to LA because he's been working out there, and then he comes back home.
That's right, and keep him busy.
But I'm not going to let you off the hook. You still have to answer my question about if you think feel can be taught.
Oh, yeah. So I think there's a video I saw of Steve Gadd, and a guy said to him, what's groove? And I'm like, this is going to be brilliant. And I'm ready for Steve. And he's in his own, of course, as he does, he takes his time. And he's like, I think groove is an agreement between the musicians. And when everyone's agreed, you know, where the downbeat is, where one is, where two is, and where it feels, the amount of swing, when everyone's agreed on, it's that amount of swing, okay. Or this is how it's feeling, essentially. And when they're all agreed, that's when it starts grooving. And I thought that's one of the best ways of describing it in such a simplistic but fantastic way, really. But I think what you said was, can you learn feel? Right. And I don't know.
I know it's a complex question because everybody has a, you know, some people think you can teach someone anything, but me personally, I think you might be able to show people what they need to get a good feel, but that still doesn't mean that they're gonna, to me, I think a feel, everybody has a natural feel. It's just something, you know, like when somebody says to you, man, you have such an amazing feel, you know, you didn't work on that.
Yeah.
That's just you.
Yeah. Well, to illustrate that, getting back to Hamish. So Hamish isn't a drummer, right? He's a guitar player and a bass player. And he toured with Ringo and he toured with McCartney for like 8 or 9 years.
Yeah. And I know he was in the band when Chris Whitten was.
That's right. And Robbie McIntosh was in the band too. Now Hamish isn't a drummer, but often when we're on a gig, he'll just sit on my drums. And it immediately feels amazing. It'll just go, it's like, oh my. And there's guys and the drummers that I know that would just die to have that feel. And it's just, Hamish is a funky guy. You know, it's when he plays guitar, whatever, he's just got that sort of touch, and he's got zero technique on the drums, and that's what's so fascinating, really, is actually he doesn't practice, he doesn't play, but it still immediately feels better than a lot of guys that play 8 hours a day.
and that's just natural, because even when he plays the bass, he's got unbelievable feel. And you know, let's face it, for Paul to let him play bass.
I know, the big deal.
That in itself says something, you know, right off the bat. So, you know, I always like to ask that question every once in a while, because, you know, there's so much about that people don't understand. You know, you can be great technically. And, you know, that's the only thing I worry about with all the younger generation coming up, playing along to all these, you know, records that they love with all this chops and all this, you know, it's very robotic kind of sounding, and that's great to have all those chops and everything. If that's the kind of drummer you want to be, that's fantastic. But the drummers with the feel, we all know, like, that feel is your hug, especially in a ballad or any kind of song, even if it's a dance song that's going to get you moving. It's the feel that, I mean, of course, we as drummers, we all need to play in perfect time. That you can be taught. That comes with practice, I believe, you know, that can be taught.
Yeah, I agree.
You can practice your rudiments and practice your hands and practice everything else. But when you sit down to play, I always feel like either you have it or you don't. Because like you said, there's some drummers, like when Hamish sat down, there's drummers that are great, technically great, but they won't feel as good as somebody, you know, that doesn't play.
It's amazing. It's worth doing a whole sort of range of podcasts just about feel. Because get Steve Jordan on and Gadd and all those guys that...
All the guys like yourself that you admire, Keltner, Gadd, I mean, anybody that, especially studio people, most of the time the studio musicians, you know, and that's why when disco came out and the drum machines and everything, you know, that was a purpose. That was just to get people to dance. So you really didn't need a feel. But then they realized, well, a feel is still needed. So they would have you play. I would go in, you know, when I would do sessions in those days, play on top, you know, the Simmons, play on top of it. So play a real hi-hat or add a snare drum every once in a while in between the machine, because they realized something's missing. What's missing? Something's missing. Yeah. It's too, like, you know.
It's absolutely. Andy Newmark, for instance.
What a drummer. Andy's another.
And, you know, that dude, I've seen him play eighth notes and I've gone, you know, two and four eighth notes. Why does it feel so amazing? It just feels, it's ridiculous. But if you write it down on a piece of paper, my 8-year-old daughter can play it.
Right.
But it doesn't feel like that.
At clinics sometimes, when Modern Drum used to sponsor clinics, sometimes some of the guys used to have three or four different drummers come up, play the same exact beat. Now, all these guys were excellent drummers. I mean, they could all play.
Yeah.
But you can hear it's the same exact beat, but you can automatically say, that feels so good.
I know. Not
to put anyone down, because I would never want to do that. But you can see where it's like you just, your ear and your body and the way you feel just goes to that drummer's feel.
I know, it's amazing.
You're one of those guys, man, because...
Well, that's very kind. I mean, I've always wanted to try and, you know, I've always been drawn to feel music, you know. And I've always aspired, and I still aspire to, when I sit down, one of my things was, I want to be able to sit down and play something simple, but make people go, what's he playing? Because I saw it in action, you know, with the likes of Newmark, actually.
You know, and Ferroni, like you said, when Steve came in.
Again, you know, on that gig that I talked about, when Steve came and finished the second set, basically, and I sat on the floor, you know, I was inches away from a guy and he just counts the band in. And he's another one. He's just playing eighth notes and very simple patterns. But there's something about it that makes the whole band feel comfortable.
Right.
And then they find the best spot that they can possibly find. And
They go into what Steve said about everybody being on the same page, more or less.
That's it. And he makes them feel great. And I've always wanted to be that drummer where people go, oh, I want to play with him again, because it sort of feels cool. Because, you know, let's face it, you know, guitar players and keyboard players, they're not looking at the drums like we look at the drums. Right. They want the fundamentals from it, really. Singers want the fundamental from you. They want a dynamic. They want you to push the music when they're in that spot that they want a bit of dynamic push. They want you to come down. It's song. That's why songs for me are the biggest deal, really.
Yeah, and also, and see, you have both, because you have an amazing, beautiful feel. And I try to stress to the younger generation, you're also a beautiful person, human. So, a lot, you know, there's so many great drummers, and you can have that feel. But if you have a bad attitude, they might get the guy that don't have 100% the feel, but he's a great guy, and they want to be around him.
That's, you know? Yeah. So there's something to be said for that. And then if you can get the combination, if you can play and you're a nice fella, Steve Gadd again, you'll be working until you can't walk.
All the guys who see, they all have that common thread. All the guys who kind of like go off the deep end and, you know, their ego kind of gets in the way, they kind of wind up, you know, drifting away, only because nobody wants to deal with them, no matter how great they are.
That's right.
Absolutely. So I compliment you on that, and I want people to know that, you know, yes, the talent, of course you have to have the talent, and, you know, but to keep it going, you know, and then proving, like you said, everybody wants, once you have that one hit, then of course,
yeah,
overnight you're a different person. Everybody's treating you like a different person, even though you're the same person. Nothing's changed except now that record, which you didn't even know was gonna, some could happen or not,
yeah,
became a hit. Now all of a sudden, you're even greater than, you know, everyone's acknowledging it.
Yeah,
but the attitude is a big thing.
Well, it's interesting when you introduced me, and you know, it's amazing you went down the list of those achievements that I feel very lucky to have achieved, the numbers and all that. But if you think about, I think I'm proud of my achievements, but I'm very realistic about it, and I think about Gad and some of the guys that are still playing, and like my achievements are absolutely minuscule in comparison to some of those dudes. So hopefully, but that keep, I, I'm not, it's not.
They're also, I love all those guys, but they're also older, much older. So sure. they've been doing it now. So you're going to be those guys years from now.
I hope so. I'm just going to keep chipping away, Billy. And it's so far, touch wood. You know,
people
keep hiring me, and I've kept the same, you know, because no one tells you, no one says, oh, the things that we're talking about, no one really sits you down and says, you know, you've got to try and have a good work ethic. You got to try and get a good sound. You got to try and make it feel good every time. You've got to try and all of the things when you're a young drummer, it's about technique and
right.
sound and how fast you can play.
right.
And actually when you, after 10, 20, 30 years, then you start realizing actually that it's a much bigger thing going on. I've just tried to try and play with integrity and try and let the music dictate to me what I'm supposed to be playing rather than my ego dictating what I'm supposed to be playing or what the latest trend is or, yeah.
Yes, and as a session musician, we know that sometimes the part may not be working that they want you to do, but you have to try to make the producer or the songwriter or the artist happy. And you, before you open your mouth or before you're asked, well, what do you think?
Yeah.
You know, that's a hard thing to learn because some guys will go in, you know, I've sat on sessions and some guys, you know, the songwriter or the artist sit there, they'll play the acoustic guitar and they'll say, I want you to play this on the drums. Now, you kind of know that's rubbing and it's not really gelling for some reason.
Yeah.
You know, but you can't, some guys will go, no, how about this? Before they're even asked or before they'll even try it, you know, they'll say, that's not going to work. You know, how about this? So like you said, your ego cannot, it's not about you. It's about who's hiring you and what you're, you know, you're playing on. It doesn't come down to playing everything that you know. That gets you fired so quick.
Yeah. And you know, I learned very early on that all of the things that us drummers might look at and look up to, often producers and most importantly, singers, really, for me, it's like, what do singers want from us? And often it's not what drummers want from us. You know, they want dynamics, they want feel, they want support, and they want taste, actually. They don't want you to do a drum fill over the top of their chorus or to crash that cymbal at that moment when they're about to go for the chorus or whether in the middle of a really nice note in that verse. But I think these are the things that actually I don't think can taste in music. I don't think some people have either got it or they haven't. And some people have got it in bundles. Like they play nothing and it's so beautiful, you know. And I'm still aspiring to be that person.
You know? Yeah, Steve, well he mentioned Steve, we mentioned a couple of the guys.
Yeah.
But absolutely. And let's, before we go, let's touch now on live playing. Cause you had that balance. You did a lot of sessions and then a lot of live playing. So I never knew that you were a band member of Delamitri, because I loved that band from back in when their first album came out, you know, in the 90s.
Yeah,
I never knew that, you know, I always knew your name, of course, and then as years went on, I kept hearing more and more and more and more and more and more. And you won our Reader's Poll last year, which you're up again in the Reader's Poll this year as well.
Yeah.
So I started to become more and more aware of what you've done, but I didn't know that you were in Delamitri, because going back to, like, I listened to that as an album.
Yeah.
And I liked the songs and I liked the band. And let's talk a little bit about your experience, because you left and then you went back and now
you're back.
New album coming out next month, correct?
We've got a new album coming out. It's on, I think it's the last day of April it's going to be released. It's a great sounding record. Just the singer, Justin, is really, he's a proper talent. So he plays and lyrically writes all the lyrics, and he's a fantastic singer in his own right. He's the bass player in the band, which is unusual as well. So when we're live, there's no extra bass player that's in the back there. He's the guy that's singing and playing bass. And the new record is called Fatal Mistakes, and I'm really proud of it. I've just done, hopefully, played how, again, same as any other record that I would play on. I've tried to serve the songs as well as I can. And sonically, I mean, and also I know that band well now. I joined Delamitri when I was 24 and I'm 52 this year. So, you know, I know those guys and I know where that music's coming from. So, and I think the record sounds good because of that, because we're all, you know, we're definitely on the same page after that amount of time. But
you spent a lot of time on the road with them in the 90s.
Yeah, well, back in the day. So when I joined, there's a great drummer called Chris Sharrock, played on a record of theirs called Twisted. And he was a really busy session guy in the UK at the time. And he didn't want to go on the road. So Delamitri finished this record and then they needed a drummer. And I was very, very lucky. When I moved to London, I moved to the same street as the great bass player Pino Palladino, and I didn't know this. until I was coming back. I moved to London when I was 21, and I came back to my flat with a pint of milk, and this guy comes out of the house with a bass on his back, and I'm like, oh cool, there's a musician on my street. And anyway, it transpires that it was Pino, and a few years later, he heard about Delamitri needing a guy to go on the road, and he put me up for it. I went up and auditioned, and funnily enough, you mentioned him earlier, Chris Whitten was auditioning before me, and I could hear him through the door, and I'm like, this guy's unbelievable. And I said, who's that, to one of the roadies, and they said, oh, it's that guy Chris Whitten. I'm like, oh well, I've got no chance, you know, absolutely no chance. And he sounded fantastic. And I thought, well, he's got the gig. So I went in and I was very relaxed because I thought, well, I'm not going to get the gig. I may as well just enjoy the experience. But, you know, gigs, there's often other reasons why people get gigs. And I eventually actually did get the gig. I think Chris might have been a little bit more expensive. he'd just come off the road with Dire Straits. I was young and I had passion for going on. They wanted to do a lot of touring in America, so we did months and months in America, and I think Chris might have probably got, you know, he would probably would have lost it after a couple of months.
Well, whereas did he was that before Paul or after Paul?
It was after Paul, so we'd had a after, you know, he'd had the most amazing experience of touring Paul McCartney.
So, yeah. And Dire Straits, McCartney.
So, right. You know, he might not have lasted 3 months on a tour bus with a load of Scottish guys. So I got the gig and I loved it. And I toured a lot. And it was right in at the deep end. Woodstock 94 was my fifth gig. And we supported the Stones, REM, Bon Jovi, Van Halen, Bryan Adams, who I ended up playing with a few years ago. And very early on, some really great experiences in my early 20s. And then I went on to tour with Squeeze.
Yeah, that's right. For two years, right?
Yeah, about 2.5 years I was with Squeeze, and I did a record with them, which they don't talk about much. But
that was their last record. Then they took a break after that, didn't they?
They had a break at that time, and now they're having a bit of a renaissance now. People are loving them again, and they're still sounding fantastic. Squeeze, brilliant British songwriters.
I know, they have two drummers that I get confused with them.
So Newmark toured with them.
Yeah, at one time, right?
And the drummer that was with them originally was a guy called Gilson Lavis.
Yes,
who plays with Jules Holland, and he's fantastic. Gilson,
and then Simon, right? There was
that's right. They've got Simon Hansen now. Is their current drummer? Yeah. So I toured with Squeeze, and I toured with Marianne Faithfull for about a year. That was Andy Newmark put me up for that because he just didn't want to tour. And I remember thinking, what do you mean you don't want to tour? And now I understand completely. I don't really want to.
I know. Tour.
Andy was like my age then, and I get it now. You know, it's like. It's a thing, isn't it? You sort of grow out of it eventually. I mean, I would tour with the right band if they came along, and I will tour with Delamitri again. They've got a tour booked in September, COVID, you know.
And Lisa Stansfield, right?
I toured with Lisa for a while. Yeah,
that's Lisa was popular here for a good number of years.
Yeah, Gavin Harrison used to play for Lisa, and it was Gavin put me up for that tour.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yeah, Gavin in the 90s, when she was really, really big in the UK, that's when I first saw Gavin playing, was probably about 97, 98. And yeah, he put me up for it. And I'm really glad he did because I met my wife on that tour.
Ah, oh, there you go. You see, a lot of people meet their mates and their wives on tour, yeah. which turns out, you know, it's a good memory. And and then if you weren't on that tour, you know, because I always like to think of, well, if you didn't do this, it wouldn't have led to that. It wouldn't have led to this. It wouldn't have led to that.
That's it. Life.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, before we let you go, because I know we could stay on with you all day, and David's going to ask you a question.
Yes.
Ash, tell us about working with Adele.
Adele? Fantastic experience, you know. A really, really fantastic experience. So, is it the best bit of the Adele story is I toured with Rick Wakeman, right? And he has a roadie that is called Doom, his name is. and basically what happened is his drummer, he had a long-term drummer, still has him, a guy called Tony Fernandez, and he broke his arm. I'm touching wood now, but he broke his arm just before a tour and obviously couldn't do the tour. And the bass player contacted me and said, Rick needs a drummer for this tour. Are you up for it? I was like, absolutely. He said, wait, he said, listen to the music before you say yes. And I listened to all this Wakeman stuff, and it's, you know, 1970s English prog rock. It was something I'd never really dabbled with, you know? So I thought, this is going to be a real challenge learning this stuff. So I said yes, and the gigs were amazing. We did Cuba, Puerto Rico, Costa Rica, Mexico City supporting Asia, and then Leicester, which is in England, which isn't so glamorous. So there's like sort of five or six gigs. But the point is that they said, have you met Doom yet, who is Rick's tech? And I said, why'd you call him Doom? And they said, oh, you know, he's sort of, if he won the lottery, he'd be sort of mildly put out. You know, he's just that guy that's sort of like, but actually when I met him, he really, really wasn't like that. He was a very sweet, kind, fantastic.
He was probably just mellow.
Really, really cool. And actually, you know, he said that he was into Aretha Franklin, and he recognized that I like that sort of music, and we got on immediately, and we did the gig. And I remember we were in Cuba, and he said, oh, you should meet my mate Fraser. And I said, who's that? He said, oh, he's a mate of mine, he's a producer. And that's the first time I'd heard Fraser's name. And Fraser also played guitar with Rick. Anyway, cut long story short, I play on a James Morrison song with Nelly Furtado called Broken Strings, with another producer produced it, and it was a hit in Europe, number one all over Europe. And Fraser was one of the writers of that tune. And then the next thing I'm getting this guy Doom saying, you've definitely got to hook up with Fraser. And then eventually I got a phone call from this guy. He put two and two together. He was good friends with Doom. And I'd played on a record, which was a number one for him. And eventually he called me for a session. The first session I did with him wasn't Adele, but it probably was one of the early sessions. And what I say to people, you never know. Like, there's a direct connection between Rick Wakeman, like 1970s English prog rock, and Adele, like a definite link.
Wow.
You know, there's no question about it. You know, if I hadn't done that one, then maybe the Adele might not have happened. But often when you do sessions, I'm sure it happens in the States as well, you don't know who you're playing for. You just turn up. And I turned up, Fraser said to me, what are you doing Thursday night? And I said, nothing. He goes, great, I've got a session. I went down, took my cymbals, opened the door, and she's just sat on a stool looking at her phone. I was like, oh, it's for her. Okay. And she was really, really into the music, you know. And the record was almost finished. So the tune that I played on was a song called Set Fire to the Rain. And it was pretty much the last song that was going to go on the record. And she was really excited about it because it was one of the tracks that really sounded poppy to her. And she was massively involved. Like she was really involved in the way that it felt and my performance, making sure that I was giving as much as I could for her.
Cool. Well, I want to thank you so, so much for taking this time. I know it's nighttime there for you.
Yeah.
And again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Billy, for asking me. Yeah.
No, it's our pleasure. And I'll let David say goodbye.
Thank you, Ash.
Thank you.
Amazing insight, amazing playing. Thank you for all the years of great hits, no pun intended. And and we really appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you so much, everyone. And
thank you, Billy.
Everyone.
Thank you, guys.
Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you so much.
Keep safe. Thank you.
Everybody, stay healthy, stay strong, keep drumming, and we'll see you next time on the Modern Drummer Podcast.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in, and we'll see you soon.